Hello and welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. Today we have one of the most data-rich conversation in the show's history as we host Vice President and General Manager of Fraud, Risk, and Compliance Solutions at FIS, Eric Krause, along with Lead Analyst of Fraud and Security at Javelin Strategy and Research, John Buzzard. FIS was a platinum sponsor of Javelin Strategy's 2022 Identity Fraud Study, and Eric and John share their interpretation of the most interesting data from the survey of 5,000 U.S. adults. The survey covers 2022 specific fraud trends for consumers, for merchants, and for card-issuing banks, emerging trends involving social media, traditional fraud on existing accounts, on new accounts, and account takeover, phishing scams, social engineering, fake charities, peer-to-peer apps, and fraud take center stage for a bit, consumer confidence in fingerprint, facial scanning and voice authentication, as well as a discussion around removing sensitive transaction data via tokenization. Lastly, the conversation touches on how banks can combat the perception that they're the ones to blame for transaction fraud. Without further ado, let's take it to the show. So, Eric, what are some of the trends you see impacting card issuers and payment providers so far in 2022?
Yeah, there's been a lot out there that's been keeping us busy. That's for sure. On the card issuing side, I would really highlight card enumeration, or probably more people know it as BIN attacks. Extremely challenging in the current climate right now. So think of this as high velocity number guessing, for lack of a better word. These criminals are literally just coming in with high levels of different number combinations, you know, credit card numbers, expiration dates, CVV numbers, and they're just hoping to guess right and get some of those through. The high levels of remote card not present fraud continues much as we expected. And it's been interesting. We've actually started to see a material increase in some point of sale fraud. So think of automated fuel dispensers in particular, and some other of the older schemes that we would see more at a point of sale. We're starting to see some rise of that. Of course, account takeover is a constant threat. We've seen that trend up recently from what I would call some pandemic lows, where we hypothesize organized crime was much more focused on stimulus payment money, unemployment benefit fraud. So believe it or not, some of the traditional account takeover seem to take a little bit more of a backseat to some of those other schemes. We're starting to see, absolutely, with that other well drying up, we're starting to see account takeover start to increase back to some levels that we had seen pre-pandemic. And then I would say, you know, merchants, you know, if I look at the merchant side, first party fraud is still one of the biggest complaints of merchants. Within our own merchant e-commerce space, we've seen numbers as high as 80% of disputes really being of a first-party nature, or merchants reporting those as a first-party nature. So that's a big challenge on the merchant side. And then I would probably say digital skimming is another one, big threat in the merchant community. And you know, often those digital skimming and hijacked or hacked merchant sites often become the feeding ground for some of the criminal attacks on the banks and credit unions and issuers as well. So super important that we focus on both sides of the ecosystem. You know, John, I know you have a very broad sense of the overall industry, and you get a chance to research a lot, have a lot of experience in this. What maybe are you seeing across the industry in 2022?
Well, for one thing, I think we're seeing a real increase in the amount of automated attacks across the digital channel, whether it's a bot attack, whether they're powered by artificial intelligence or machine learning, which kind of makes them maybe more of a risk than a routine risk, in the sense that we just continue to see a lot of crime as a service and malware as a service schemes that are going on out there. And a lot of this kind of culminates with credential stuffing attacks and then scams targeting consumers that have a cryptocurrency theme is something that I absolutely am starting to pick up on. And what I mean by that also is we can have now, in any one particular day, someone affected by almost like four scams mashed together, Eric. So it could be something that is, some people might write it off as sort of like an elder abuse scam, but it also has like all of the ingredients of like a tech support scam. It involves having that victim remove or take cash out from their bank and then convert it into cryptocurrency and sending them out into the world to upload that cash into a cryptocurrency accepting ATM. So, I mean, just, it's kind of like Joker's Wild right now, I think.
Yeah, you know, you touch upon a lot of similar themes, and you know, my botnets you brought up, and you know, very much relative to what I was referring to back with some of the card enumeration and bin attack schemes that we see. A lot of that, you know, is typically perpetrated by botnets and the like. So, and also the cryptocurrency commentary, you know, it not lost on me either. We're spending a lot of time looking at those risks and exposures as we go forward, hoping to empower, you know, a greater acceptance of crypto and giving people the sense of safety there. But it's funny too, you know, you say Bitcoin ATMs, and I've heard a lot about them, but believe it or not, the gas station, the small independent gas station down the street from me just opened up a Bitcoin ATM. So just it's just wild, to your point. It is kind of Wild West.
So, Eric, the FIS acquisition of Worldpay significantly increased your merchant acquiring footprint. With the scale of your issuer processing businesses, have you found any synergies when it comes to fighting fraud as a result?
Great question, and certainly something we've been highly focused on as we have come together as two organizations. And I think it's important to understand, certainly stopping fraud is super important, right? I mean, that's what we're here to do and protect the bottom line, protect consumers, protect the firm. But we can't lose focus on the most critical player in all of this, which is really the consumer and that relationship that is important to us with that consumer. And that is why we've really leveraged the combined assets of the two organizations and found ways to, for example, streamline digital commerce with no increased risk of fraud across the merchant, bank, or credit union ecosystem. The creation of a true ecosystem between issuer and merchants has been a big focus of ours as well, where we see improved consumer experiences, higher transaction approval rates, and of course, reduced fraud exposure. To be a little bit more specific about some of the things that we've been pushing out, we've created trusted merchant programs, for example, so some of the best consumers of merchants can experience a more streamlined approval process, again, with no increased risk to the issuer or the payment provider. We have already laid the foundation for what we're kind of internally referring to as a fraud fusion center. And the idea there is to merge fraud data intelligence and emerging threat vectors and signals across all payment channels and really stay proactive in front of these schemes instead of reacting and learning lessons the hard way. And then the last thing I would highlight is just bringing our combined data assets has given us the ability to integrate some new predictive risk scoring models, making our real-time decisioning even more intelligent. And the idea there is, of course, to increase your fraud detection while at the same time lowering what is often called false positives or your false declines. Those can be detrimental to a healthy consumer relationship. So those are some of the early highlights that I would point out today. And I'm happy to say the early results look promising. And, you know, FIS is certainly not unique. And I know, John, as you look out to the greater industry, do you think that some of what FIS and others are doing, are we on the right track? Is there still more opportunity to really harness the power of these, you know, disparate or often disparate assets and data models?
Well, absolutely, because even with the research that we've conducted in the past year just around identity fraud, there were significant themes around merchant activity, meaning that, you know, consumers were experiencing either a net loss or businesses that were in the e-com space, et cetera, really had to battle that sort of scenario of new account fraud and account takeover fraud. So at least 30% of all fraud victims had some type of linkage back to like the e-com channel, which really dovetails nicely with what you're doing in that issuer merchant ecosystem that you're setting up. But also, you know, this is a real critical time for organizations to coalesce. And as you sort of alluded with the Fraud Fusion Center, I'm loving that very much because our research shows that consumers really want more resources. When they come to this digital destination, whatever it may be, they're looking for guidance. So it's becoming absolutely necessary to kind of squeeze the information grape to see where remediation is needed. So even if it's an internal effort, just having the transparency, as silly and perhaps as often touted as we talk about organizational silos and transparency, it is really important in becoming a game changer to be able to kind of look from the top. You know, you're in the virtual helicopter, so to speak, Eric. What's happening across like the, you know, seven lines of business that you're responsible for? Because I'll tell you what, criminals are probably attacking more than one of them, and it's the same people. But you may not know that until you start looking for it. through some of the ways that you're talking about. So good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's super helpful, and not just validation for, you know, some of the things we're doing here internally, but, you know, just understanding that there's real value to these things, and we're continuing to get smarter and more intelligent and driving towards more connected decisioning, where you do, to your point, understand pretty much, you know, that consumer's behavior at any given time, at any given channel that they might be transacting with you. So it's great to hear, and it's great to hear that some of your research is bearing out what we suspected, and should provide a lot of benefit to the industry as we go forward.
So, John, FIS recently sponsored Javelin Strategy and Research's annual ID fraud study. What are some of the key findings that you found in this year's data?
Well, there were a lot of interesting numbers to look at. I think the thing that is top of mind for me is the overall loss number. It was $52 billion. And you have to pause for just a moment, because that truly is $52 billion with a B, affecting 42 million U.S. adult consumers. So that's a lot of loss and a lot of net U.S. adult victims of identity fraud. We had increases pretty much across every tracked category for fraud that we look at, including some pretty powerful numbers around new account fraud, where there was like a 109% increase, and account takeover fraud with a 90% increase. Now, if you boil all the categories down and you look at the average, we had a 79% increase year over year. There was also, as I mentioned earlier, a real strong, you know, merchant theme, whether it was an account takeover, identity fraud scam. Victimization definitely occurred through a lot of those channels, including P2P products, where individuals sort of stepped outside the lines of terms of service and sent money to strangers when they know probably very well that they shouldn't, but also delivery services. Lots of very interesting things there around fraud losses. I would say, to summarize this, we're kind of back to pre-pandemic criminal behaviors, and we definitely are seeing, you know, consumers trying to navigate through all that. You know, they tend to be the least protected and most vulnerable, and criminals have tapped into that. You know, why go try to break into a bank that has superior technology in place when you can victimize a consumer through a social media platform and trick them out of their credentials and then just go take over their account anyway? Yep. And I know, Eric, that's probably that's a daily thing that's probably on your mind between the account takeover and new account fraud, just, you know, rising up with technology to fix it.
Yeah, absolutely, John. And you know, I highlighted ATO trends in a little bit earlier during our discussion. And, you know, again, your research bore that out to kind of show that increase was real. A new account fraud, you know, I didn't touch upon that in my earlier commentary, but you're absolutely right. You know, whether we're talking about merchants, you know, banks, credit unions, even, you know, neobanks and some of the other, you know, fintech providers, let's call them, that are in the payment space. I mean, new account fraud is just a huge, huge issue. And with the proliferation of synthetic identities that are available out there, you know, you've got friendly fraud, you've got some organized criminals, you even have disingenuous cardholders that are just trying to game the system themselves. And, you know, it'll be interesting whenever we get into, you know, rougher economic patches, if you will, and you know, there's a lot of talk about will we go to recession and things like that. There's greater incentive for, you know, people to perpetrate first party fraud. So it'll be interesting, you know, to keep an eye on that as potentially economic factors change. But I think interesting findings. We're very happy and proud to continue to support the research and look forward every year to sponsoring it. And I think maybe one last topic here on this, John, that I'd be interested, only because we've spent a lot of time the last couple of years talking about scams and really mm-hmm. the target rich environment that the pandemic created when it came to scams. And if I am interpreting your research correctly, we did see a little decrease in that. I mean, again, we've talked about some of where the other trends have now popped back up, ATO and application fraud and things of that nature. But do you think that some of the decrease maybe in those type of scams was a result of the constant focus on consumer education that we've had in the industry over the last 18 to 24 months?
Oh, well, Eric, without a doubt. I mean, everybody is messaging around scams in general, and I think that it's working. We really did see some significant dips. I had an individual ask me yesterday, as a matter of fact, if I feel like next year it's going to be lower than it was before. But let me just recap this. Like everything that has sort of like a dip or a reduction, keep in mind there were $28 billion related to identity fraud scams, where criminals convince the consumer to do something that eventually, or to divulge something that basically ends up as identity fraud. We were down, I think, about 12 million victims, which is enormous, but there's still a lot of victims. My worry is that we'll get a little too relaxed, and I don't want anybody to do that, but I do want everybody to kind of push on the gas harder. Refine your educational messaging, because something is clearly working, and I think it's just that constant drumbeat. It just has to be short, succinct, and penetrate into the psyche of the consumer when they're in the moment. That's really the important part.
Yeah, no, thanks, John. And I'll leave you with this. I often call it, if I was in a rock band, I'd call it playing the greatest hits, because you can never emphasize too many times consumer education. And as many times as you think they have it, complacency can easily set in. And it's just important to keep that message front and center. Proper cyber hygiene. Don't overshare on social media. Don't reuse passwords. Like I said, it's the greatest hits list. So I appreciate you giving us a little bit more insight. And it's super interesting to see 12 million less victims on scams, but still millions out there that were victimized. So thanks, John.
Sure.
So, Eric, there's been a lot of press recently on P2P apps and related scams and fraud. What makes users so vulnerable in this particular payment channel?
Yeah, you know, this one is one of those that there's a lot of conversation around this. There's a lot of debate around this today. So when you think about, you know, P2P apps and what they were really designed for was moving money to people that you know. Things like, you know, splitting a bill with friends over dinner, paying your handyman that you've had working for you for a couple of years, you know, people that you know. And, you know, now it's kind of morphed into, you know, a regular payment type. And, you know, with that, and I think John's comments earlier kind of highlighted some of this too. I mean, criminals are going to follow where the trends are going. And so, you know, P2P is kind of a great innovation. Let me just say that, you know, the ability to instantly move money from one person to another is a phenomenal innovation, but it's important to remember it's instantaneous. So when you hit that send button, it's gone. And this is not your traditional payment card where there's a, you know, easily and well-structured dispute mechanism. So, you know, right now there's a lot of debate about who should be responsible for this. And, you know, there's several class action suits. We won't get into this right now with some of the larger providers and of P2P technologies out there, including large banks, credit unions, and it'll be interesting to kind of watch where this movement goes. I mean, putting aside some of the politics and that kind of stuff, there's just basic security features. I mean, one of the most simple that we recommend is just ensure that you're using some kind of multi-factor authentication when you're, you know, leveraging these type of apps. And unfortunately, MFA is often not the default setting within an app when you download it. It's something you have to go out and configure yourself. And so, you know, be cognizant of that and just ensure that wherever you can, you're using the best step-up authentication and multi-factor authentication to really help protect the account. So, you know, John, you're probably a little bit more in tune than even I am these days with kind of the movement in the industry around, you know, consumer protections with this and the like. I just curious on your perspective of where you kind of see this going as we move forward here.
Well, I think one of the things that everyone that's offering this type of, you know, I call it an amenity because it's a benefit. Amenities are always good. But we have to do sort of that buyer beware to the consumer and just keep trying to socialize the notion that unless you've had a relationship with this person to the extent, a great comparison that I use a lot is if you've sat across from the dinner table with the person and you have that kind of a interpersonal relationship, it's probably okay to initiate a peer-to-peer payment. Otherwise, it falls into that murky territory of, oh, the want is stronger than the sensibility behind it. So that's a huge problem. From just a long-term business model perspective, I think that as the CFPB really continues to push out their messaging about what counts and constitutes a restorable fraud loss for the consumer, there's going to have to be a moment where financial institutions in particular really pay careful attention to that. So it's, you know, the vehicle is the same. It's just everyone needs to kind of decide what their rules of engagement are around it. I've received recently this week, as a matter of fact, kind of like a very interesting write-up from my own financial institution that talks about if you've suffered a loss from certain different products that you use. And they outlined a pretty nice program around it in terms of giving me 2 or 3 days to report fraud from like a almost like a real-time payment perspective. It was
very interesting.
Really was. So it's I found that flexible and very consumer-centric, but I think we'll probably just see more of that evolve over time. That would be my guess anyway.
So, Eric, static passwords continue to be the prevalent user access control for digital commerce. Is the industry aggressively moving to more secure methods such as biometrics?
Great question. Yes, I've been encouraged. So we kind of go back to some of the research discussion that we had earlier with John and what Javelin had produced this year and you know, many years in the past as well. And we continue to see a trend, which is very encouraging, and that's consumer confidence in methodologies like biometrics is increasing. So, you know, they're liking it more. They're getting more comfortable with it. And let's be real. At the end of the day, the industry is going to follow what consumers want and what consumers accept. So I think it's important that we as an industry continue to focus on biometrics and even intelligent ID authentication innovation. You know, where can we work to continuously remove sensitive data wherever we can? Tokenization comes to mind. So if you think about tokenization of transactions as an example, this allows for, you know, the same kind of commerce, the same kind of money movement we do today, but we're removing any of the sensitive data, and now it's just a token. So if a criminal does happen to intercept the data or somehow, you know, gets involved or hacks into the system, all they're going to see is a series of, you know, hashes or, you know, encrypted information. So there's really not a whole lot they can do with it. So I continue to see statistics, you know, even on, you know, what we call secure e-commerce and, you know, things like tokenization or, you know, some of the secured commerce type step-up authenticators that are out there. And, you know, the U.S. has a long way to go. We lag the rest of the world considerably. If you look at some of the stats that the network card brands put out, I've seen some that indicate Europe in particular, almost 60% of all e-commerce transactions are truly secured or what they consider secured. And that typically means it's either tokenized or it's going down some kind of step-up authentication path. Here in the States, it's mid, you know, teens. So a lot of opportunities still to go to catch up on that. And, you know, there's a lot of different reasons and drivers and, you know, fragmented networks and different, you know, kernels was the latest one I was reading about on contactless. You know, there was no standard for the kernel that's needed to accept the contactless transaction at the point of sale. So there's, I don't know how many different number out there, and now EMVCo is working to kind of standardize that. So super important, back to your original question, I do think that the static password is starting to, you know, see the backside of itself. We got more clients that are getting much more comfortable with biometrics. You know, we all had iPhones forever that had thumbprint capabilities. We're all now staring at our phones and opening them up. And so we're getting a little more comfortable with facial scanning and recognition. I've got a lot of groups working on voice biometric capabilities, voice as a password, predictive, you know, voice interrogation around inflection and voice tones and all this other kind of stuff. So a lot of good capability that will move us forward and get away from these static passwords. I mean, I still get emails about passwords that I had supposedly 15 years ago that have been breached and somebody's trying to use it against me. And I'm like, I don't think I've visited that site since, you know, 2005 or something. So it's still out there. I know this is a hot topic for you, John, because we, again, have had the pleasure of being able to speak to this together. Are you seeing that comfort level? I mean, again, your research bears some of that out. It's one thing for people to say that to somebody conducting a survey, but what do you think in practicality? Are you seeing an uptick in adoption in the real world?
Well, I think that an adoption in the real world, that's happening maybe a little slower than I would like personally. We evaluate consumer trust every single year. We had some really stunning numbers this year. So when we ask consumers to rank the security of authentication methods, really the top three, fingerprint scanning, 80% trust, facial scanning, 74%. I think retinal scanning was 70%. Voice authentication went from 50 to 54%. Those are all really good things. That tells us that consumers are kind of leading this in a way. At this point, they're dragging us behind them when we probably should be at least, you know, in lockstep with them in terms of adding things. You know, consumers are still using passwords because that's all they really have. They need to be probably in the next couple of years become more and more cosmetic, meaning for a consumer that just doesn't feel comfortable unless they put that old password in, go ahead and let them have that, but build really strong multi-layered authentication in the background that nobody sees that takes fractions of milliseconds to make good decisions to let good folks in and keep the bad folks out. I mean, that's what we're all really working towards. And I know you're doing a lot of work around that too. And that's just the wave of the future. It has to happen.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm just curious, John, one of the stats, do you find it interesting that people are more comfortable with scanning their face than using their voice?
I think that it's all about what they're seeing and using today. So if if you're a frequent flyer and you and I've been in the TSA line a million times, mm-hmm. you look over and you see the people doing like the other version of entry, which is the retinal scanning. So people see it that way. And then in Brazil right now, I believe MasterCard is trialing, I think what they're calling sort of loosely smile and pay. So mm-hmm. you just run off to the grocery store. It doesn't matter if you've got anything on you or not. You're going to do a retinal scan or a facial retinal situation there, and they're trialing that. So I think as people just get comfortable, they start to realize they're not just watching like a movie like Minority Report. and it's like, no, this is actually real. It's something that's come to fruition. So I think that's why that comfort level is there. I think voice is great, Eric. I love anything that's going to do the heavy lifting for me in the background. If I don't have to put in an OTP number or anything like that, I think, why not? Go for it.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think most of the people I talk to tend to share the same opinion. So I appreciate you sharing that perspective.
Sure.
John, staying with you here for our final question. It's often assumed that a victim is going to turn around and blame their financial institution for any negative impact associated with a fraud event. How can financial institutions combat the perception and differentiate themselves through their resolution capabilities?
Well, sure. Let's keep in mind here that by the time we learn about the consumer struggles with identity fraud, that poor person is pretty worn down to the nub at that point. So they're stressed out. I've had sort of what I would call like a near total digital takeover once, and it was really scary when you think about push notifications coming to you telling you that phone numbers and emails have been changed on some of your accounts that could be very sensitive financial accounts, followed by phone calls and text messages, et cetera. That's really, really jarring. So we just have to remember that, you know, the consumer's stressed. They're spending about 16 hours in some cases trying to resolve their problems. But there's some things that I think are really great out there that we want to see financial service providers develop more. We've spent a lot of time this year around research asking consumers what they really liked and didn't like when they were encountering sort of like a fraud claim situation. It turns out almost half, like 49%, actually watch fraud prevention videos if you offer them. You know, the rub here, the caveat is whatever you put out there, the consumers are actually receiving it, reading it, and finding it very useful. More than 90% of those consumers actually found the information that their bank provided to them from a fraud prevention perspective is really useful. But here's the crazy part. 52% assume that their banks didn't offer anything because they couldn't find it. If you bury something behind 25 clicks and it takes me a long time to find it, I'm probably going to opt out and call the customer contact center, wait in a queue, and then I'm going to really let you have it when you finally get to me in the queue. So it's just easing up. Improving the client experience, I think, is really a big part of it that takes that negative aspect away. I don't think the consumer's going to walk away from you the first time there's friction or a problem, but don't give them any reason to have friction or a problem. And so this will be like some of the focus, I would think. And Eric, you have your own opinions on these things too, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I think you've touched upon a lot of great points there. I often will talk to institutions. If done right, you can differentiate yourself as a secure provider, as a place that people want to come, feel safe, and never concern themselves with, you know, fraud or other risks. So, you know, I think it starts with a lot of what you said, you know, clear communication. I mean, you even go back to some of the commentary we talked about with Zelle and some of the things that I read that, you know, consumers are challenging legally around is like, hey, you never told me any of this was risky. Now, you know, I have my own opinions about, you know, some buyer beware stuff and things like that, right? But at the same time, I think clear disclosures, I think clear best practice information. And again, you know, I jokingly brought up again about the Rock Band Greatest Hits, but we are so desensitized to best practices and, you know, what we should click and what type of information will never be asked of us out of the blue from a call from our supposed institution, financial institution, that I think we think it's just second nature to everybody. And I'm still amazed at how often I'll go out and talk to groups and or even look at, you know, research across the industry of how many people still fall for very basic, you know, phishing scams and things like that. So as much as the industry for God, at least a decade that I've been, you know, pushing these messages has pretty much been focused on this consumer education aspect, I think we all agree there's still a long way to go. And it's probably the repetitive nature. You just got to keep pounding the message to fight that, you know, risk of complacency that you highlighted a little bit earlier.
I would agree with that. I mean, just keep in mind, think of it this way. This is just my own humble opinion here, but when you have a digital presence with a website, you need to start thinking about it like a living and breathing thing. And as soon as you stop nurturing that and feeding it with good information, timely updates, things that are meaningful for the people who are using it, you immediately start to reverse and work backwards against yourself. You know, it's all, yeah. I'd say this, but it's all in what you put in it.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. I think that's spot on. Spot on, John.
So, gents, this is a really cool conversation and fascinating data. We touched on issuers, merchants, consumer trends. So we really, really hit the wheelhouse from a payments fraud perspective. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your expertise.
My pleasure, and thank you to my partner, John, as well. It's always great to get an opportunity for us to present with our friends over at Javelin.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.